You are listening to Attention, the audio journal for architecture. This is issue number 8, talking about my generation. Interviews were conducted by Joseph Bedford between 2021 and 2022. I'm Tim Cox, the guest editor and narrator for the issue. This is episode number 5, Aesthetics. When asked to describe the aesthetic output of their generation, this cohort didn't describe any singular, coherent project, but instead emphasized a variety of camps, attitudes, and highly specific interests. Some respondents saw many similarities, while others saw irreconcilable differences. While they aren't rallied around a nameable style, the group did share common aesthetic enemies in the smooth perfection of the parametric project and the largely nondescript architecture of corporate America. While perhaps obvious, these two rejections locate this generation as the latest iteration of progressive, avant-garde, or experimental architects. While we will hear few arguments for a specific aesthetic project during this episode, the group does share an underlying belief in aesthetics. And as we heard in the previous episode on the digital, this generation was formed in relation to digital tools, so their aesthetic output is always in conversation with their proficiencies in softwares and fabrication processes which fueled the parametric project, but which this generation is putting towards different ends. In an effort to identify a shared attitude or aesthetic in this generation, we took Michael Meredith's 2017 Indifference Again article as a starting point. This essay, which was published in Log during the first Trump administration, attempted to bring a wide swath of practices, many included in this issue of Attention, under the position that Meredith called indifference. In the article, Meredith argued that architecture is split between a camp of engaged problem solvers, from those practicing parametricism to those working on issues of sustainability, and the titular indifference camp, whose work focuses on banality, is delivered in a monotone, and refuses the urgency of the moment. As a whole, the interviewees strongly disidentified with the label of indifference. The essay hit a series of generational pressure points. It produced a set of binary camps with ideological positions. It echoed sentiments of Eisenmanian disciplinary autonomy. And the word indifference itself was not what this cohort thought of its politics. Here are Clark Tenhouse, Kyle Reynolds, and Curtis Roth on their responses to the essay and its attempt to produce a legible grouping of work.
Indifference is a tough one, because I think there's an appearance of indifference, which can be a really productive way to foster engagement and invite like new interpretations. But I've never really seen it as an attitude of indifference. You know, it's more about the kind of the display of it or its qualities as manifest in architecture, which is really different than previous forms of architecture, which we might call heroic or authored or something like that. And so, yeah, the qualities of indifference, I think, are different than an attitude of indifference. But ultimately, I think that what I'm seeing is questions of informality and how can informality be a productive way forward for art, everything from composition to social experience to political critique to environmental response.
Even though we're kind of grouped together in the indifference article, I'd say they're very distinctive differences between the work that people are developing. So some, you know, very focused on representation, the way that drawings can translate into a type of architecture. Others much more focused on materiality, the development of novel materials, the introduction of digital fabrication techniques to produce installations and other objects. And then others, you know, interested in maybe recuperating different types of histories or projects from the past and rethinking and re-envisioning them for the future.
I think he's on to something that might link a whole group of practices. And I'm not sure that that something is indifference, because when I think about myself, it's not something that I would like to have attached to me, I guess. And when I think about many of the people in that group, I wouldn't describe them as indifferent. I think there's a couple issues that maybe he identifies that are, for me, really resonant. One is the kind of a more complicated relationship to authorship. The other thing that I think is really useful in that text is the idea that maybe that group of people, they take the kind of aesthetics of the work as bound up in the instrumentality of the work. Many of those folks make the problem of separating architecture's instrumental capacities and its sort of aesthetic or cultural capacities, they make that more difficult.
Respondents struggled to find an aesthetic description for this generation as a whole. And perhaps it is accurate that the range of aesthetic output simply doesn't fit under a single term or camp. At stake in this question of naming an aesthetic group is a curatorial and editorial effort to find aesthetic arguments that are larger than individual practitioners. Here's Hans Tersak, Meredith Miller, and Paul Preisner.
No one wants to claim authorship. No one wants to pin themselves to a style. No one wants to pretend to be the author of a style. Nor are people, it seems, of my generation comfortable with being camped in these ways. We're more likely to give you a list of 10 things like that than we are to say that, I'm the precarious group. It's like, no, it's going to be precarity, you know, piles, whatever, slumps, that kind of thing. A long list of things, actions, descriptors, etc.
Where I would start is to question whether there is a kind of monolithic tendency or a single umbrella that all of those practices would fall under. I tend to think that there's a range of, you know, interests and aesthetic sensibilities and motivations and objectives that those designers are all pursuing. And while I definitely see overlaps in many of the practices, I don't feel that it's monolithic. And I tend to see that the moments of gathering or kind of collecting underneath the exhibitions or publications that you mentioned, I feel like it's pretty loose. And maybe that's the point for some of those editors or curators, is to kind of pull together a loose collection of practices that have the same amount of experience or, you know, around the same moment in their career, and just to kind of look at where there might be overlaps, where there might be differences, but not try to label a single tendency that they would all fall under.
It's really difficult to say who's doing what, because there's a lot of shared formal themes and material themes and compositional themes and programmatic themes in a lot of people's work right now.
Christy Ballier reflects on the output of the group and on the aesthetic categories for sorting work that she helped establish for the 2013 Possible Mediums Conference. When asked to categorize the aesthetics of the group brought together by this issue of attention, she just didn't see a way to make those judgments.
I don't know that I could at this moment. I think it is, if at the moment when we were developing those things, you know, we were talking about things like sort of micro categories, right? And we were referencing websites where it was doing micro categories of music and architecture was doing the same. And we were absolutely referencing Michael Meredith's work in 2007, his ability, like everyone's interest in making these kind of lists, right, as a way to do that. I think we are, you know, if that was sort of micro categories, we are now in, like, we're splitting hairs at this point. I would have a very difficult time. I would need to think much longer than the length of this discussion in order to think about how I would begin to categorize positions at the moment.
While the inability to find a shared aesthetic project was the dominant sense, several interviewees did reach for explanations of this group's output. Their answers varied, but between Mira Henry, Jaffer Kolb, and Stuart Hicks, the relationship between this group's aesthetics and meaning was a central concern.
If I were to zoom way out, I would say that this is the kind of moment when the autonomy project truly died. It's done. It's totally done. It's totally done. You can't produce anything that has meaning if you can't connect it to something outside of itself. That's what I would say is what we're seeing in every single practice right now, and trying to figure out, kind of orient one's work and one's production, not necessarily changing techniques. I mean, there's techniques are shifting for sure. Interests in things that are, let's say, messy form versus virtuosity is certainly a kind of big part of the contemporary aesthetics. Craft is returning, right? These things are all present. But I would say all of the people that I think are working right now are, if they haven't already, are still are right now trying to struggle to try and figure out how to orient meaning outside of insular and fundamentally internal conversation.
there's like a lot of acts of reassembly. There's a lot of acts of trying to bind these within systems of semantic meaning that seek to reshuffle them through what some people call, you know, new methods of formal generation. Others might call like a kind of queer practice of camping. Others might call through the kind of inclusion of digital technologies as a way of reassembling them. But basically, what I think a lot of these different sort of branches share is a desire to simplify the terms of architecture in order to design things that don't necessarily privilege novelty, newness, innovation in the way that I think a generation before us, there was a pressure to do so.
There's a collective reinsertion of the conversation of meaning with form and its relationship. There was a time at which people thought they understood the relationship between meaning and form, and then there was a time, because they saw a dead end there, that that wasn't a topic worthy or possible for discussion anymore. And then I think my take on the generation a little bit is a sort of re-embrace of the possibilities of at least thinking about the relationship between meaning and form.
So far, we've established the difficulty in holding together this group's aesthetic output under a single banner and have seen their resistance to being neatly divided into camps. However, as we heard in the previous episode on the digital, a key unifying feature of this group is their critique and rejection of the Parametric Project. While they previously discussed their disillusionment with parametricism's promise of liberation through technological progress and the style's distasteful entanglements with capital post-2008, we will also hear a united rejection of the aesthetics of parametricism from this generation. Positive descriptors for the digital project, like smoothness, continuity, novelty, complexity, or singularity, are all negative terms for this group. Next, we'll turn towards a string of aesthetic keywords, words or phrases that kept recurring in our conversations and which form an interconnected web of interests. We'll hear about formlessness, informality, discrete parts, messiness, the dumb or crude, simple or DIY construction, and an interest in familiar or known forms. First, here's Kyle Miller and Hans Tursack on this cohort's interest in the formless.
I think there's paradigms surrounding formlessness that I think challenge the elegance of the single surface. So I'm thinking of, you know, some of the work that Adam Fury was doing, but also Kovacs, like in a different way, each of them pursuing formlessness.
An interest in the formless is a pretty common denominator. I think a lot of talks by contemporary architects, you hear the word entropy come up, and references to Smithson and the post-minimal artists of the 1970s who were interested in material behaviors as a way of determining compositional ideas. So Smithson, early Richard Serra, Ava Hess, Linda Banglis, that sort of set from the 1970s seems to have like a second life in experimental architecture, with people, myself included, using physics engines and simulations in digital software, or sometimes directly using materials in controlled experiments.
Next on our list, informality. The informal was understood as a loosening of compositional quote-unquote rules and a new tolerance for imperfection, dissonance, and multiplicity. This group was invested in the term not just as an aesthetic descriptor, but also as a way to begin making arguments and claims about their work. As with the formless, the informal was understood first as a rejection of the aesthetics of prior architects, which were seen as too hierarchical, too rigid, and too smooth. Here's Clark Tenhouse, Kyle Reynolds, and Meredith Miller.
The larger umbrella would just be informality. There's an attitude of informality in the work. So whether it is slumpiness or droopiness or haphazard stacks or scatter plans or cut up gable roofs, there is a kind of controlled informality that I think is really at stake in a lot of the work. And I think that that is a way to move away from conditions of hierarchy, a way to subvert sort of normative, authoritative power, at least in representation. I don't know if it works the same at a true political level. Informality, or the appearance of informality, suggests a kind of loosening of architectural composition, architectural representation, who architecture is for and what its capacities are. And so that's how I would describe it in a word, which would be it's about informality.
So I think one of the aspects of that is informality, or kind of loose arrangement of objects in space. And so you see that in a lot of work and played out in very different ways with different material constructs. But that might be one area where I would say there's a consistency or an interest in abandoning kind of formal, rigid, highly geometric structures to organize space.
Maybe this is, again, another example of something that's not smooth, but within the object, the kind of fragmented nature of it, the unresolved, the non-homogenized, that there's something about retaining a narrative that has to do with, you know, multiplicity, whether that's multiple authors or multiple histories or multiple trajectories that arrive at this moment, and that that's a temporary condition, because those fragments can kind of come apart again, or there's some other process or next chapter of that history that can unfold. And if I were going to try to generalize, again, referencing back to your earlier question about a kind of generational tendencies, I want to say that there's something in that resistance to smoothness that I feel like I could attach to many of those practices.
Under the umbrella of informality was another series of aesthetic descriptors, fragments, discrete parts, and piles. Perhaps we can read this generation's refusal to subsume individuals into groups or camps as another manifestation of this aesthetic interest in retaining the qualities of distinct objects in larger assemblages. The ability of parts, fragments, or authors to retain their individuality was very desirable for this generation. Perhaps the pendulum has swung from a parametric obsession with the whole over its constitutive parts to an interest in maintaining the legibility and clarity of those parts. Here are John Lott, David Eskenazi, and Andrew Holder.
I look at it, squint test, at a large range of work, and I see a description in the arrangement of difference. And I say the word arrangement because it reinforces a kind of eclecticism, formal eclecticism, which is about how things are arranged such that you can see the lack of resolution or the inability for things to fully resolve. And so there are piles and fragments. But there's also a kind of embrace of the common and the rearrangement of familiar things, more so than completely alien form, let's say.
We see a lot of discrete parts, but the parts are not like of a single object. They're of maybe accumulations of things. There's a sense of the objects themselves are not enough. They have to sort of speak to the things that they came from. So I think, aesthetically, I think it's more of an aesthetics of pointing elsewhere.
My interest in the fragment goes like this. So the first is maybe it's the one moment where I do understand internet culture in the sense that it's given us generations of people who are expert editors and who are expert at marshaling like very large quantities of things to do work. And so I just think maybe there's a natural facility with my generation, except that matter and information like comes to us in chunks, and that we already have these like very well refined powers for managing those the flows and disposition of those chunks. The second thing I'd say about my affinity for the fragment is that I kind of come around to it from like a quasi metaphysical position. I'm totally enamored of Michael Fried's essay Art and Objecthood, particularly when he accuses some of Robert Morris's sculpture of having of harboring an inner secret life, as though the kind of implication of hollowness not only made the Robert Morris sculptures anthropomorphic, like hollow like bodies, but also animist, like they're going to go do something. And so I'm enamored of that essay because I think he has correctly named a series of properties of objects that they can seem as though they are occupying space in the way that we do. But I think he's got the value system completely upside down. That in fact, whereas Fried is kind of adamant that we hold on to the kind of picture discourses of objects and that we do not let them lapse into just like inert material that occupies our space, I just think, like, how wonderful would it be if we could read everything around us in the way that Fried is afraid of? And so in our own practice, we try to maintain the discreteness of things so that we hold open the possibility of reading them as objects.
In a similar vein, Matthew Au and Neron Turan both reached for the word messiness as a way to name a compositional attitude and an interest in the ability for objects to communicate distinct aesthetics and histories. Here's Au and Turan.
One thing that interests us about materiality is its messiness. Its messiness in the way that it comes with its own histories. It comes with its own ways of engaging politically. It comes with its own references. And that through, let's say, all of those things together, that is a sort of way of thinking about our work. It becomes that sort of moment in which the work engages with the world. It engages with its history, with the sort of buildup of social relationships. It carries a baggage with it, material often does.
I think that there is an interest, maybe a different understanding of technique that wants to confront things more in a messy way. Or maybe we can even say that accepting of the messy could be another maybe way to put it, instead of trying to purify things. Because when you emphasize problem solving, you have to purify. You have to clean up a little bit.
Across formlessness, informality, and an interest in discrete parts, we can begin to see this generation's desire for an architecture of distinct elements which are assembled into a provisional whole, but that retain their individual ability to perform programmatically and communicate semantically. This raises interesting questions about what makes a good part, what makes a lack of resolution compelling versus poorly executed, and what is at stake discursively in this, beyond the negation of parametricism. Next, we'll continue down our list of keywords, towards those that steer the discussion closer to questions of practice, client relationships, and budgetary restrictions. The dumb, clunky, or boring are words this generation has frequently used to describe itself in a playful reclamation of the pejorative. Paul Preisner and Jerome Hafford both found an interest in crude, clunky work through their relationship to practice and the inability to work at heroic scales with vast budgets. Preisner, who recently released his book, Kind of Boring, identifies the 2008 recession as the moment when he became interested in reclaiming these negative descriptions.
When the world's money caught on fire at the end of the aughts, that just made any type of work that I had disappear. So I had to figure out a new way to work. And I don't personally know people with money or enough of it to do architecture work, but I do know people and I have friends who are contractors. And so I was getting offered or given the opportunity to work on smaller projects like little renovations or a house or kind of apartment buildings, but obviously with like budgets that were just paltry. And those types of budgets don't work for the type of work that, you know, comes out of computers. And I wanted to kind of do architecture, so I had to kind of refigure what my approach was to find a way to make really limited means intellectual project in itself, and to make maybe architecture that's boring not be uninteresting, but to find a way to do that. And so I tried to explore like crudeness, right? Because sloppiness is something you can do when you don't try and you can do it really cheaply. And I wanted to figure out a way to maybe produce some intellectual rigor so that could be a kind of architectural project in itself.
I think a good friend of mine, Joffre Kolb, for instance, I like how he talks about some of those clunkier shapes, that there's an acknowledgement of the sort of realities of practice and the realities of imperfection and the politics of imperfection. So to me, some of those clunky shapes start to speak a little bit more and resonate with me more when we start to frame it on those terms. Decentering of a sort of Platonic perfection as somehow more true in how we might think about aesthetic or compositional baseline for form making and for architectural space.
However, Andrew Holder reacted against this proliferation of self-depreciating formal descriptors while reflecting on his participation in the 44 low-resolution houses exhibition and conference, a Princeton-hosted group show curated by Michael Meredith.
The structure of the conference is that all these architects who'd been asked to participate get up in various configurations, and you have a little panel discussion, and then the next panel comes, etc. And I was toward the end of the day, and there's always a kind of luxury to being last, because you can just listen to what everyone else says and then react to it. And it struck me that almost to a person, everyone had characterized their work as being dumb or simple. And that started, I guess, to bother me a great deal. First, because it was pandemic. Everyone thought that about their own projects. And, you know, entire books and essays were being published with a kind of like deliberate claiming of the negative. Like, I'm boring, I'm dumb, I'm simple, I'm bad. But it also bothered me because I think it is disingenuous and maybe undermines the architect's capacity to work in the world in a way that makes me very uncomfortable. So a firm like First Office will talk about the dumbness and badness of their model making in particular, but I don't know of a practice that is more obsessed with precision, or I don't know of a practice that has mined more precision and frankly beauty out of a deliberately off-kilter joint. So there is a way to read, for instance, their PS1 Dolmen project as deriving all of its aesthetic power from the joint out. The joint is not some badly done residue of a dumb process. It's in fact exactly the moment of incredible specification down to kind of like the quarter of a degree that then requires a whole tectonic system in order to sustain this little crevice of light between, you know, two boxes that are rotated very slightly. Beyond that, I think that there are some very smart detailing decisions being made and some very powerful claims for audience effects that are being made that I'm reluctant to put under the banner of the word dumb. I don't think these are dumb at all, and I would rather that architects not be self-effacing or kind of assume a false modesty that communicates well on Instagram, but maybe doesn't fully like assume the powers that they're putting in play.
In response, we'll hear from Anna Niemark on how she understands this generation's interest in the banal details of construction and where she once again claims the negative.
I think what brings a lot of our work together maybe has to do with a desire to bridge the gaps of previous generation that were constructed kind of for political purposes, the gap between academia and practice. In order to bridge that gap, the work dwells on construction, on materialities, on fabrication, and turns the kind of professional practice of architecture into an academic pursuit. And so as a result, there's a kind of over-aestheticizing of the everyday, down-to-earth, the low resolution, whatever term you want to put into this. The attention to detail is just another emphasis as a kind of set of people who in other contexts would probably have built a lot more than we have in this particular American context. And so as a result, we dwell on details that are truly like stupid pixels, vectors, you know, paint samples and screwdrives. It's like, surely we have better things to do as architects than dwell on those insignificant details. But we want to put our energy into something. So we kind of zoom in and we slow down and we kind of produce arguments about these things, but it's sad, really.
Across Preisner, Hafford, Holder, and Niemark, we can think through this generation's usage of pejorative aesthetic descriptions as a way of negotiating their need to produce aesthetic work in their academic posts while struggling to find well-funded opportunities for built explorations of these aesthetics. In trying to make meaning within tight financial constraints, they aestheticize ubiquitous, standard details. As Niemark notes, there's a melancholy in this turn, an admission that larger architectural and urban questions are hopelessly out of reach as practice becomes more and more hostile to academic architects. However, the embrace of weak aesthetics and self-effacing language can also be read as a carefully calibrated iconoclasm, a pointed rejection of an architectural culture which emphasizes singular authorship and mastery over form. But the work is still, as Holder reminds us, very considered, and its apparent simplicity is chiefly enjoyed by an expert audience of architects who can read the deadpan humor and intellectual rigor in its crude joints. The ability to walk the line between the bland and the sophisticated is only possible for those with well-honed taste and compositional ability. Next, we will turn more broadly to the aesthetics of construction in this generation. There was a renewed interest in basic building materials, from nails and screws to stud walls and rain gutters. As with labels of crudeness, the celebration of banal, mass-produced items was characterized by interviewees as an adaptation to tight budgets and a way to imbue generic construction norms with meaning and quiet provocation. Here are Katie McDonald, Jerome Hafford, Kyle Miller, and Jimenez Lai.
If the digital project was about high resolution, exemplified by architectures like Gehry and Hadid, an economic collapse makes those things less desirable, for sure. It starts to make sense that things would be more haphazard, lower resolution, more economical means of production, maybe both because of the availability of money, but also the perception of high-cost materials. You know, if you look at Aaron Bessler's installations or Michelle Chang's installations or Anna Niemark's installations, they all seem to be about just slightly altering conventional construction techniques as a, again, a kind of meta project, but it's about a kind of low cost imposition into the system.
There's kind of aesthetic position coming out of a bit of a scrappiness. That's a nimbleness with the tools and a kind of aesthetic economy that comes with deploying those tools in spite of, but within constraints of a building. There's a bit of an embrace productively, I think, of practice as a sort of transcendent force in shaping our field and our aesthetic output. The performance of being a practice is itself another set of constraints that act upon the form of something being produced. It's not a technocrat position. It's acknowledging that practice is this performance and involves these kind of this other layer of forces that I think allow for a kind of authorship to come back in a little bit.
There's a more peculiar way in to some of this other work that engages with the banal that I think is just beginning to be unpacked, right? I'm thinking of Lyda's furniture, and again, team's interest in off-the-shelf, hacking conventional assembly systems, but still maintaining a kind of aesthetic rigor and elevating them. I know New Affiliates is interested in the same thing. Like, Evie was really excited that they're going to work with granite, like, make granite cool again or something. But I think there's just a different ambition that my peer group and certainly the peer group after mine has to elevate the banal and the quotidian as opposed to start with the grandiose as a given.
Dare to be mild is maybe a way I would describe Andrew and Anna's earlier work. So for Andrew and Anna, like, how do you paint something white in 5-10 different ways on the same surface? So mild, amazing. But in the hands of maybe Bessler or others, let's do that with studs, or let's do that with, you know, other catalogs, like things that are that you would think to be the most flavorless, sort of, you know, like bland banality, can we turn that into something daring?
Finally, we'll conclude our list of aesthetic keywords with the familiar or vernacular. Linked directly to the interest in off-the-shelf materials and mild effects we just heard discussed, this generation also deploys familiar forms and typological cliches like gabled roof houses. These vernacular forms put architecture in conversation with questions of signification, reference, and the ability to communicate meaning through building. But to state the obvious, discourse around vernacular architecture is not synonymous with neoclassicism or a desire to return to quote-unquote traditional modes of building, nor is it an acceptance that the building stock that surrounds us today is aesthetically rich enough to merit uncritical reproduction. To take the example of pitched roofs, this generation isn't producing pediments or accepting the standard construction details of paltry overhangs, visible gutters, or high contrast trim that accompany the vast majority of contemporary pitched roof houses. Instead, they worked with the pitch form of the roof, but rework its aesthetic expression. Familiarity becomes a departure point for design exploration. Here are Christy Ballier, Clark Tenhaus, Joffre Kolb, and Hans Tersak.
We're not as interested in seeing the aisles of Home Depot in a new way. But I do think we are interested in working with things that are sort of familiar, but maybe not as obviously familiar. The idea of, you know, seeing our role as producing something that fits in dialogue with a context or with an understanding of a general public, but also I think seeing our role as a way to kind of push those boundaries and to offer at some moments something that maybe isn't quite expected.
People are working on things that we might describe as relatively familiar or on a kind of spectrum of familiarity, but they are also introducing sort of intentional manipulations to them. They're sort of perverting them. They are manipulating them. They're abstracting them. They could be kinky. They could be droll. They could be critically banal.
I would maybe think of the aesthetics as falling under a category of what you could call neo-traditionalism, which is to say, we've called this many things: neo-postmodernism, the new ancients, the familiar, the canny, the known, the vernacular. But I think that our generation seems relatively bound by an interest in taking pieces of tradition, and that can look like pitched roofs, or it can operate like an obsession with balloon framing, stud walls, typical assemblies that you might read in a Sears home catalog in 1924, and exploring them and updating them, although maybe not even updating, maybe then just literally exploring them.
There's usually a sort of careful dance between exploiting vernacular that belongs to a specific place, time, and culture, and sort of extracting abstract principles from a vernacular where the reference is both specific enough but also abstracted enough to be something else. That definitely seems to be a common thread in that work.
The question of pitched roofs became a specific site where this generation took positions on the debate around signification, and which represented, for some, the return of postmodernism. Here's Michael Young, Stuart Hicks, Joffre Kolb, and Andrew Holder.
There's a generational moment as well in terms of in which ways questions that were initially offered by postmodernism return, and return in positive lights as opposed to negative lights. To be as simple and as dumb as we can sometimes, it's helpful. Who here would use very clearly and unapologetically and even celebratorily a pitched roof? Which architects would care about that question?
You get people studying gable roofs and defamiliarizing the familiar. I think that that's a pretty common trope. So taking things that are familiar and defamiliarizing them in various ways and playing with that process.
There's a kind of friendly vernacular that's associated with a lot of those, like the relentless pitched roofs, this idea of something that feels familiar, but that's actually recoded as a kind of like design act.
The last 5 years worth of single family homes constructed by my architects of my generation, almost to a person, they have like a perfect pitched roof. I don't know, do we owe that as a debt to like some kind of hangover of Alpine architecture? I don't exactly know where it came from, but they've got a perfect pitched roof.
And to round out the discussion, Michael Meredith recalls a conversation he had about pitched roofs with Jesse Reiser during his 44 low-resolution houses show.
I upset a lot of people with that show. I honestly didn't even think it was an upsetting show in any way. I remember Jesse talking and saying, like, the pitched roofs really upset people still. And, you know, what did he say? I thought it was hilarious and it's smart, but I just don't get it. He said, when I see all these pitched roofs, I just think of all the Jewish families who got Christmas trees. I didn't even understand what that meant at the time, but it also was like impediment, you know, like in a way he's thinking about it through some other thing that I just don't have access to, like the pediment, like everyone sees it and thinks of like classical pediments or something. And I was just like, for me, it's just a roof, man. And if you want to build in these conditions that we're in and with these horrible money constraints, you're going to probably end up with a roof like this. So, and you're going to have to learn how to deal with it and make something of it.
Another key component to understanding the aesthetic output of this group is their attitudes towards representation. As a generation who has, at this point in their career, produced more speculative projects than realized ones, representation offers a way to think through their architectural interests. The drawings, images, and models not only propose possible built objects, but are a field of design research unto themselves. Here's Michael Young and Eric Herman.
I am always interested in the ways in which architects begin to produce images as discursive arguments, and in which ways do those images themselves carry the ideas of the project, as opposed to whether or not the images they're creating speak directly to the physical built world that they're trying to represent. That's just a long-winded way to kind of think about the project of representation and aesthetics in representation versus aesthetics in the built artifact of the architecture. But I do think that each of these architects at one level or another are positioning themselves through modes of representation and aesthetic arguments within representation that tie to popular culture, histories of art, issues of photography, issues of the graphic in terms of the communicative potential of graphic design and graphic work.
One thing that strikes me that categorizes all this work is a kind of certain restlessness about the limits of architecture's communicative power. I don't want to describe it in terms of forms and shapes. I want to talk about like what I think it is. And I think it is an interest in how architecture functions more as media. And so I think that in a lot of this work, there's an attempt to signal and communicate and explain more than a building can, and somehow like trying to stretch that capacity. So things that characterize the work, you know, include elements that are legible, certain like repeated tropes, a really strong interest in representation as a thriving and expansive practice, not of documentation, but of actually representation as a space in which you can design and communicate and work.
Building on Herman's argument, the role of architectural representation is shifting not just within academic circles, but within culture more broadly. The proliferation of computers, the internet, and social media have produced an environment where images can be produced and circulated quickly. Several interviewees pointed out the ways that Pinterest and Instagram impact how architects, and especially students, represent their projects. While these platforms provide access to huge amounts of high-quality work, they also produce cycles of representational styles which feel more trendy than thoughtful. Here's Kyle Schumann, Katie McDonald, and Daniel Jacobs.
Manual of Section was one of those moments too, where all of a sudden the perspectival section had a rebirth, but in a super specific way with the specific gray tones and everything that was like right from that document, right? Like beautiful drawings, I love that book, but it's just so interesting that then that becomes something that's like replicated in so many schools and so many student projects. And maybe it would have happened without Instagram or without Pinterest, but I think that's these platforms and ways of communicating are certainly accelerating the turnover of those certain aesthetic tendencies. That basically results in like less time for discussion, less time for critique of those, right? It's kind of a moment, it happens, all these students do their projects with those aesthetic tendencies, and then it's maybe on to the next thing.
The visual is privileged. Schools want beautiful student work for their Instagrams. Practices want beautiful, polished work for their Instagrams. So across the board, there's a privileging of the visual rather than the description or the intellectual project behind it.
There's no question that Michael Meredith and Hilary Sample have had an incredibly large influence on the production of architectural imagery, especially in the academies. And I think that a lot of that comes from a specific set of methods of creating imagery that are very easy to replicate in a way, and that students can really hold on to and grip and reproduce. And so, you know, this is very dumb, but that moment in which every image had a gradient background and every image was a rhino screenshot that was manipulated in a way to look similar to Moss drawings, I mean, that was when we entered teaching, that was really everywhere.
The screenshot aesthetic also gestures towards the post-digital and treats the space of the software and not of the building plot as the site of design. For this generation, foregrounding the aesthetics of digital production software can also be understood in contrast to industry norms of realistic rendering, which they react against and associate with the parametric project or commercial architecture. Jerome Hafford and Brittany Udding both discussed the post-digital in relationship to representation.
There are some classically aesthetic trends that I do think have started to diversify, but were more crystallized a few years ago in terms of a kind of post-digital aesthetic. I think, again, Moss had a huge impact on a lot of this generation about how we were representing things a few years ago and still do.
When you look more at the post-digital, it was a return to the oblique, the plan oblique, the flip-up axon, the flattening of the architectural object as an image, where, again, a thing that expressed the sort of digital processes of projection and representation. If you look at the Aurelian mode of representation, you know, there was looking at the tableau, the constructed image, the flat painterly perspective, something that was more of a collage that kind of made visible this type of subjectivity that the architecture was speaking to. That was a very kind of important moment where it was a rejection of the flashy render into like a constructed image.
The model is another representational mode which this generation embraced. Hand in hand with the aestheticization of basic construction techniques, simple acts of model making are increasingly celebrated, with a specific interest in the aesthetic qualities of models themselves. Physical models offer an encounter with materials, basic tectonics, and a miniature staging of the construction process. But the status of models is complicated by the dominance of digital 3D modeling as a design process. In the same way that a model has to be photographed for it to circulate to a wider audience, representing digital models also casts the designer as a photographer. Instead of constructing a perspectival view with vanishing points, one simply maneuvers a viewport and adjusts the lens length. Here's Andrew Holder, Hans Tersak, David Eskenazi, and Naron Turan on the relationship between models and architectural aesthetics.
There's a lot of foam core and cardboard and frosted acrylic. I think the 3D print is now being used in ways that renders it sort of identical to other more common model making materials. So I see basswood back at students' desks, but I see basswood being used in ways that's equivalent to their use of 3D prints. I think there's a lot of simple tectonic work being done at desks, like taping things in place such that they can be glued on top of one another. And then I think there's the kind of leakage of these very like manual artifacts of model making into the aesthetics of the projects themselves. So like glue marks, tape, props, shims, the weights and blocks that we might have once upon a time used for drawing but are now kind of used to shore up models as they're under construction. Maybe an easy way to put all that is like, what's allowed on a student's desk right now? Like anything and everything that could be called part of model making. And there's not a lot of distinction between model making and the finished artifact in terms of what goes, like the kinds of pieces that can be stuck on and the colors, glues, and tapes.
don't want to butcher Stan's argument, but in the most recent log, The Issue on Models, I think he made the argument that the model has taken prominence over the drawing and orthographic projections or projective geometry. I think that's also something that distinguishes the work. And then, you know, you could say models, yes, both 3D models, but also physical models made to be photographed, I think is another thing that defines a lot of that work. You think about the models that Team made from Michigan for the Detroit Reassembly Project. It's exquisite, huge, you know, they were almost like stage sets meant to be photographed more than they were models. They were models in the service of producing photographs. Similarly, I would say that Moss, Hilary Sample, and Michael Meredith are one of the better offices at producing models that are made to produce high-resolution photographs in the vein of practices like Thomas Dumond.
The paper and the tape, that was a moment to bring models into a critical discussion. So we've been talking about drawings and digital models for a long time, but I always thought the physical model was way more interesting because you actually have to build it like a building. And therefore, it requires a certain amount of logistics and planning and detailing and structure and like things that are training wheels for the bigger building.
I'm interested in models. And I think that the idea of model and the way that it relates to architecture, representation, and aesthetics. And I think in the way that I understand the images or the projects that are produced when there are images involved, for me, they're like physical models, actually. Why do I say that? Because there's a depth. It's a really 3D thing. And then we take almost like a photograph of that thing to present.
Throughout this episode, we've heard about this generation's aesthetic rejection of the serious, smooth, and disciplinary project of parametricism, and their divergent interest in aesthetics of discrete parts, informal assemblies, and simple construction methods. Representationally, they move towards model making and producing accessible, easily reproducible imagery from digital software. Part of the argument we've heard for these aesthetic shifts, explicit or implicit, was for a new relationship to architecture's audience. Next, we will turn to this question of audience, which, as we'll hear throughout, is only murkily defined. What was clear was this cohort's desire to expand this audience. One way to read the contemporary interest in architecture's audience is to trace it back to the projective moment and Bob Sommel's influence. Here's McLean Clutter and Cyrus Penarroyo in conversation about their time with Sommel at UIC.
I now think that audience is a rather unfortunate word for it, but that was the word that was always used, was like, create a new audience. And what was meant by that was that we're not after the overly intellectualized subjectivity who reads. We're after the audience, the one that Hollywood can make so well, rebuilding society in a way around, and rebuilding a politics around that.
A part of that involved making architecture comprehensible and accessible to people that are not just architects. Maybe the like playfulness of some of the work speaks to that, the kind of cartoonish sensibility of some of the work, or the like representation of familiar environments through images that then get kind of reconstituted to defamiliarize you. There's been this effort to engage society on their terms.
For this generation, questions of aesthetics were always tied to this question of audience. Here's David Eskenazi, Andrew Kovacs, Christy Ballier, Meredith Miller, Andrew Holder, and McLean Clutter.
There will always be an architectural audience for every architecture, but making it your exclusive audience just seems so stupid. It's like, why would you go see a comedian where their jokes are only for other comedians?
Another way to think about my position in terms of, you know, reaching a broader audience, not necessarily bringing people to architecture, but bringing architecture to the people, would be how to make architecture fun and appealing as a way to also reach a broader audience beyond, let's say, a narrow audience of architects.
How do we expand our references? How do we expand our audiences? Those are coming from need and a desire to be more open about what happens within architecture. But also those conversations are happening amongst colleagues, right? And so then when you go back into your practice, you know, I find myself bringing some of the questions that we have within our institutions back into our practice.
Design can be open to visual influences, but translate them, you know, and kind of build on them to produce something that's familiar to people. I think it's a little bit about audience, align architecture with these existing visual tendencies or aesthetic categories in order to find audiences for architecture, but also show something new out of those ingredients that have been developed across, you know, multiple authors who are all participating in that aesthetic category.
The way I understand a lot of this contemporary work is to initiate a project of readership on the back end, like after the work is done, but it's a project of readership that is broadly inclusive as opposed to requiring like rarefied knowledge in the way that Peter would need readers of architecture to have rarefied knowledge. And it's also a project of readership that purports to include the audience as though they are part of the constructive act, even though the audience is coming on the scene after the fact. So when I see so many of my colleagues using, let's say, like stick framing, really obvious plywood panelization patterns, stock sizes, Home Depot materials, I see that as a desire to convince the audience that you too could have been part of the assembly of this thing, both in terms of its literal construction and in terms of its intellectual conception, and you're invited to the party. Architecture is not exclusively the domain of like a kind of rarefied discourse.
Thinking about non-composition or the casual, especially as the casual or the incomplete might open up venues for engagement and opportunities for the public.
This focus on audience as something that's produced through aesthetic output is interesting in the way that it understands an abstracted public who consumes architecture as visual experience. What's not as explicit in this framing is architecture's role in the social world, which necessarily interfaces with people not only as audience members or viewers, but as citizens, tenants, occupants, users, etc. Thinking back to Michael Young's comments on how this generation uses representation as a way to build aesthetic arguments, we might understand the near universal interest in engaging a wider audience as a way to make an argument for social engagement when the obvious mode of social engagement for architects, designing a public building, is more and more difficult to pursue. While this generation is broadly suspicious of the discipline of architecture and its perceived elitism and insularity, their discourse around audience is profoundly disciplinary in the way that it defends architecture as an art, like painting or film, whose aesthetic qualities can be isolated from its utilitarian material reality and studied, written about, and ultimately made more accessible. While the audience we just heard discussed was abstract, in several conversations, audience was understood more directly as the people who produce and pay for architecture. Aesthetic concerns were still foregrounded in this framing, but respondents were grappling with how to translate their academic, disciplinary work into something that was feasible and attractive to clients. Katie McDonald, Kelly Baer, Kyle Miller, and Meredith Miller discussed this tension between one's disciplinary ambitions and the public's appetite for architecture.
People's work matures. It might start as a kind of formal invention or inventing a practice and a brand, but then it quickly gets into, well, how does the work find an audience, a client base? Who is it meaningful to? Who receives it? And that seems to be something that I would say the Possible Mediums group has done. You know, I think if you look at their early work, it's high level, beautiful, and more formal in its premise. And then as we get further into the last decade, the work starts to be more targeted towards certain issues.
There's a question of who is the audience for this work. It seems very academic, or it seems very kind of disciplinary. And I think one of the things that we've been working to do is kind of make that transition to tap into the larger publics, but without losing the disciplinary slant, I think, in the work. And that's something I would say all of our generation is struggling to do as they make the, you know, transition into the next phase of work. I don't know that any of us in, I don't want to speak for our entire generation, but I don't know that any of us want to continually rehash a thesis. You know, I think we want to contribute things to the built world.
The people that you're speaking to in this series have gone in a couple of different paths in the last few years, one being more focused on trying to practice in a conventional way. And I think that just provides a little bit less room for a singular conceptual aesthetic. I know what Team is doing, I admire quite a bit. They're trying to push some of their interests in off-the-shelf material in a way that Gary did, but in an updated way. I think they've brilliantly combined a lot of their individual interests into a project that feels quite fresh now, but it's not being filtered through recurring academic exercises. I think they're trying to practice now, and that's just going to happen at a slower pace, maybe in the same way that Jennifer Bonner is working, LADG. They're now engaged with the marketplace, and they have to consider taste in relation to resale value and developers' demand. So I think the more compelling aesthetic conversations now probably happen in the generation below.
When I think of Team's audience, I again kind of go back to this idea of our immediate relationships and how we can reach and make our ideas understandable to the people that we work with. And I actually think that that's something that our training as architects, even academic architects, has really prepared us for.
Stuart Hicks was a notable exception in thinking about audience not as the people who saw his work or who commission it, but as a public whose relationship to architecture can be shifted through outreach. Hicks has a YouTube channel that at the time of recording has over 500,000 subscribers. He posts roughly 15-minute videos on a range of architectural topics, from drop ceilings to the Art Deco revival or the architecture of McDonald's. Here's Hicks.
This reaching of audiences thing, it's kind of at the forefront of my thing, maybe because I have this YouTube channel now. There's a lot of talk about audiences at UIC. How do we reach new audiences? It feels like the conversation sometimes gets really disconnected from the reality of reaching audiences, though. So this conversation about new worlds and reaching new audiences feels disconnected from the reality of that. So, you know, I was like, well, I really want to reach new audiences. And so I'm going to try and start a YouTube channel where the audience is and try to meet them where they are and get to conversations that we're having.
This generation's aesthetic interests and drive to engage a newer, larger audience resonate with the questions that animated architectural discourse during the 1980s, when postmodernism was in full swing. Once again, architects are asking how to produce work that threads the needle between pushing the discipline forward and taking into account the popular taste of non-expert readers of architecture. Beyond these shared discursive concerns, this generation also employs aesthetics which read directly as postmodern, with an interest in shapes, cartoons, and playful formalism. After years of being dismissed, postmodernism bubbled back up in American academia with a repaired reputation. POMO was no longer seen as the house style of multinational capital or the aesthetic expression of choice for tacky strip malls across the country. Because of its unpopularity with older generations, and its total rejection of the digital project, postmodernism became countercultural once again. Here's Jimenez Lai, Kyle Miller, and Joffre Kolb.
I remember during those transitional moments, everyone was making fun of things that looked remotely postmodern. Everyone was making fun of things that are quote-unquote stupid or quote-unquote shallow, as though to have formal qualities is to be dumb.
There's a category of shape, which is antagonistic towards the elegant single surface that really just dealt with the immediacy of shape and figure and its associative capabilities, maybe in a lighter way than postmodernism did when being an antagonist to modernism, just trying to make things more accessible and immediate, and broadening architecture's audience away from the kind of alienation of the, again, the kind of elegance project, which I think was very much inwardly focused.
If postmodernism outside of architecture was about systems of language that could basically perform multiple tasks by association with their histories and also their speculations, then what we can borrow from that is less about form. So it's less about the fixation on typology and more about a generosity of interpretability. In the sense that, like, if we can make work that many people can access in many different ways, we're doing something a lot more oriented outside of architecture than purely trying to speak to an architectural audience and throwing a bone to the public by adding, you know, the metonymic chimney that's supposed to, like, act as symbolism.
However, not everyone was in support of this generation's take on postmodernism. Paul Preisner was critical of the revival as ultimately too easily digestible and lacking a political point of view.
People 10 or so years younger than me started to get reinterested in American and British postmodernism, probably because they were young enough that it was something they never directly experienced, so it seemed new to them when they first started looking at it, right? Instead of something that they had kind of direct experience living in or seeing people do. And so they got interested in it because it was also somehow the opposite of the parametric project in a formal way. What I found difficult, I guess, to accept with it is the postmodern project to me was really great because it seemed like a very political project of which the aesthetics attached to it were served an antagonistic purpose to push back against the modern project. Over the last 10, 15 years, as it got rewarmed up, their rewarming of it also had to do with the success of Sam Jacobs and Fat and stuff, and showing that it still does have some teeth as a political argument, but it ended up being a real superficial love of just the shapes and colors of the project and not really caring so much about the kind of conceptual project or maybe the kind of political project of what it was.
One of the key terms that's raised by this resurgence of postmodern formal themes and discursive concerns in academia is irony. For Charles Jenks and the postmodernism of the 1980s, irony or double coding was a way of allowing a project to be legible and exciting to both expert architectural audiences and everyday people. The generation we are discussing throughout this issue of Attention are facing similar circumstances. They're a group of well-educated academics whose careers hinge in part on their level of taste and cultural refinement, which is in tension with their interest in speaking to a broader audience. Irony is a clear strategy for negotiating this friction and making work that is legible to the public and is also discursively interesting for architects. But this generation has an uneasy relationship with irony, often feeling that it makes fun of those who aren't in the know or who don't get the architectural joke. Despite this, they're a cohort who foreground humor and direct historical reference in their work far more than their teachers. Here's Kyle Miller, Joffre Kolb, Stuart Hicks, and Jimenez Lai.
There's ways in which, let's say, the practices that I would say operated in the early Moss lineage, so First Office and Aaron, there was a sense of double coding there. There's something for us and there's something for other people. Let's put gutters together and see what type of composition we can make. And people will get it because people know gutters, but architects will understand the cheekiness of it. Or First Office dealing with paint specification. There's something humorous there, like there was in the Vanaventuri house that only a small group of the population would appreciate, but there was enough there for everybody else that made it feel like it was also for them. And I find that a great strategy. It's not that you're selling out or conceding to demand. I think there's just an interest in having other people beyond your peers and your colleagues pay attention to the work. Whether or not they like it or not is a different story, but just to pay attention to it, which is what I think modernism and early digital formalism did not care about at all.
To me, the high-low takes many different forms. I think that in a certain way, it implies a rejection of unilateral luxury. It is a descriptor that rejects the idea that everything has to be just high. And high can mean a lot of things too, right? Like high materialism might be different than high formalism. When I say high-low, I think of someone like Aaron Bessler using computational technology to reinvent the stud wall so that like visitors to a museum can use their finger to draw a plan on a screen that gets generated as a stud wall configuration. That has, I think, a really intelligent system of layers of high-low. The low is like your finger, the gesture, the stud wall. The high is the kind of translation that has to happen algorithmically that basically takes you from the finger and gesture to advanced computational software that then generates a logical system of assembly and construction that then gets actually built out of really kind of low materials. It's almost like a sandwich.
I'd never want to side on the authentic, so it just like feels a little gross, but then I also don't want to side on the ironic. So like, I don't want to be in either camp, so I do think it's a really nuanced thing. But for us personally, I think humor and something being funny is different than ironic. I think funny could be an inroad for either an expert or a non-expert. The wink doesn't need to be an inside joke. You could bring people along with you. It doesn't have to be at other people's expense.
I remember going through a time when people always ask if I'm being serious. When I do my work or say the things I say, it just sounds like I'm joking all the time, but I'm not. The more I get to know these people or my colleagues were, it occurred to me at one point, this is just how we grew up. We didn't really, not trying to be ironic for a reason or for a battle. There's no battle. If there is a battle, it might be people who are slightly a generation above wanting to, let's say, quote unquote, put us in our places by labeling us as being somehow intellectually inferior by liking postmodernism.
For Paul Preisner and Curtis Roth, irony was a way of thinking about producing conceptual distance between oneself and one's output. They saw this distance as operating very differently, either as a naive desire to be freed from our social context, or as an opportunity to produce commentary about a system that we are begrudgingly entangled in. Here's Preisner and Roth.
I am of the same culture that I'm critical of. I think it's impossible to really have a distance. And I think irony is a way to imagine you do and not fully accept your role in that.
A lot of the things that I'm interested in are what I think of as really huge questions. And so there's always this problem for me. It's very hard for me to imagine that anything I would do would be sort of instrumental in somehow intervening within those very large questions, right? And so I guess one of the things that is always present in the work, for better or for worse, is a kind of distancing. I'm trying to make it very clear that what I'm doing is not sort of imagined as an intervention within the global economy of design, detail, production.
To conclude this episode, we'll hear from this generation on the question of authorship. The classical model, where an architect author produces an architecture that's a perfect realization of their aesthetic project and style, was not something that anyone in this group thought was desirable. Perhaps tainted by the Starchitect model inaugurated by Gary, something being too authored or too singular was taken as a negative. But beyond the lack of interest in this model, the group also saw it as impossible to enact in the contemporary landscape of architectural production. Here are Eric Herman, Christy Ballier, and Michael Meredith.
Things move so quickly now, and work is shared before it's even done, and so there might be the possibility of more of a shared voice. It seems to be like an impossibility of voices that are that particular. It would be an experiment that you'd have to like go and turn off all the internet and go to a cabin somewhere and like work for 10 years and emerge with something that no one had never seen. I don't think it works that way, right? Like everything leaks.
The idea that one could stake out a singular position, work on it for a while, and then share it with others no longer exists. At the moment that you are working on something, you have a responsibility to be much more active in seeking out others who are working on something similar, adjacent, in dialogue with, however you'd want to term it, in order to kind of continue to develop your own point of view. That I think to develop a singular point of view is impossible today. It is an acknowledgement that because of how we are delivered information, because of the rapid and widely available tools that so many people use at the same time and are introduced to at the same time, right? Like students and faculty are now introduced to tools within days of one another, right? It's foolish to think that anyone has room to develop a singular point of view and share it with others.
If you're just a practicing architect, say you do a cool dial or something, you invent some weird aesthetic, somebody else will just pick it up and do it. It's so easy. They'll see it on Instagram or Pinterest, and the client will put it on their Pinterest board and say, listen, I want this. And that's it. And someone else will just do it.
In a climate where a distinct, individual contribution to architecture feels impossible, it follows that academic architectural discourse would orbit around group shows and sweeping categories, an attempt to find architectural intent distributed across a range of work. Perhaps the most ambitious of these efforts, 2022's Inscriptions by Andrew Holder and Michael Hayes, sees Holder arguing that this generation has found a strategy that allows for authorship through the reiteration of existing aesthetics and typologies by new practitioners. Something like a cover song.
The cast of characters that at least Michael Hayes and I put on the table in Inscriptions are very sophisticated when it comes to sneaking authorship back on the table. We just need to look for it in different places. So for sure, they are using what seem like known armatures for their work. I'll like refer back to the ziggurat. Like we all kind of think we get what that is. But then as soon as the ziggurat is on the table, these practices take over as very strong authors, and sort of like reworking the surface of the ziggurat as though it exists as a kind of hollow core that they can then panelize and design over top of. And I think if you start to read the work that accrues on top of this thing, ziggurat, that you thought you knew so well, you'll start to find all kinds of slippages where what you thought you knew about ziggurat is not true because of the strong hand of the author working atop it. So I just think of that as like a pretty sophisticated way to be present as an author and yet at the same time be broadly legible and sort of democratic in terms of like the potential inclusivity of readership.
Zooming out even further from aesthetic groups or typologies to modes of architectural production, Anna Niemark discusses a shift from thinking about authorship to thinking about infrastructure. This framework places less focus on stylistic self-actualization and is more concerned with what it means to participate in architecture in its current forms of mediation and technological administration.
In architecture and history of architecture, we're shifting from the emphasis on the author to an emphasis on bureaucracy or infrastructure. So from the object to the infrastructure, to the background. Instead of thinking about authorship as coming from a self, I'm not sure what that would even mean, but I would imagine that previous generations would have believed in that, a kind of stylistic representation of self. Now it seems that there's a lot more of a rapport and experimentation with thinking a little bit more technically and expertly about all the different things that are at our disposal. As a result, the stylistic concern moves to the backdrop, the visual moves to the backdrop, and it becomes a little bit more of a conceptual question of how to be an architect. It's one that slows us down quite a bit.
Niemark clarifies that authorship is still on the table, but isn't elevated in the way it's been previously.
It's not the death of the individual or the death of the author necessarily. It's more the death of the hero. There isn't this one genius mind that articulates effortlessly and naturally some sort of beauty. In other words, instead of writing about Le Corbusier's genius, we can write about the history of concrete.
Thinking about the architect as one node in a network of design and decision-making that produces our built environment is not just disempowering, it also offers new opportunities for thinking about authorship. For Curtis Roth, who collaboratively produces paintings with a group of people online, authorship was a way of thinking about labor and power through the process of production.
The version of authorship, or the questioning of authorship, that I would like to kind of advocate is maybe the idea that we can imagine authorship not in a post-authorial sense, like I don't want to be an author or I don't want anyone to be author, but rather we can think about authorship as a way to like test other kinds of power relationships between ourselves and other people. I think oftentimes when we think about something as being post-authorial, it's a little bit, I get suspicious of it because it obscures a lot of the kinds of practices that we would typically not understand as authorship. For example, if we think about Mark Foster Gage's Helsinki Guggenheim proposal, we can think of that as an act of authorship, which is produced by the office, the people in the office. But there's also like thousands of people working in asset farms to produce all of the assets which are embedded into the digital object of the rendering. And so the question, I guess, that becomes really interesting, or could be really interesting, but is maybe not probed in that project, is who is an author in that project? Is the person who made the 3D model of the Pokeball an author along with Mark Foster Gage? Like, at some point, we draw a conceptual limit. Here's where the authorship starts, and here's where it stops. If there was a kind of positive version of post-authorship, it would be one which challenges that distinction between the labor of production of a 3D model or an image and the creative labor that we typically associate with authorship.
We will continue to unpack questions of authorship and audience in our next episode on politics. We'll discuss the politicizing context of COVID and the George Floyd uprisings, and the pluralistic politics of this generation, and how they understand themselves as being able to operate politically through architecture. You've been listening to Attention, the audio journal for architecture, issue 8, Talking About My Generation. Interviews were conducted by Joseph Bedford between 2021 and 2022. The editing and production was by Tim Cox. Narration was written by Tim Cox. Thanks to the Graham Foundation for advanced studies in the fine arts for their generous support. And thank you for listening.